If you started with a clean sheet of paper, you could divide history up in all kinds of different ways, couldn't you? I mean, you might have the hinge, some enormous invention like the wheel. So time would be divided into BW before the wheel and AW after the wheel. You could do it around a discovery of some huge significant continent or other. You could do it around a war. There are plenty of them to choose from. But as it is, for considerably more than just the Western world, history is divided by a person. Jesus stands at the pivot of history. All events are calculated in relationship to Christ as coming before him, BC, or after him, AD. And actually, Jesus' coming into the world also ended one ministry and began another. Some religions are better than others. I don't know if you picked it up as Kelechi read it, but that is the uncomfortable message of this passage. And if it's true, it could be very disturbing. I mean, think of the time some of us lavish on making sure we've got the right car for us, or the right clothes from the array on the shop rack, or the right electronic gizmo. And then compare that with the way some of us almost naively imagine that because a ministry offers religion, it must be the right one. In Corinth, the young Christian church that the apostle's writing to here, there's a religion with famous Bible names and concepts, and Paul still says, some religions are better than others. Some ministry is better than others. We need to check which religions are being offered, what ministry we're getting, never mind what ministry we're giving. Corinth seemed to have leaders offering some kind of back to Moses ministry, some equivalent of that occasional newspaper cry, why can't the church stick to the Ten Commandments? You know, a religion where you know where you stand, there are clear rules, it's definite what you need to do. And as he compares the religion of Moses with the religion of Christ, he doesn't say that's bad and this is good. He actually says that was glorious. This is even more glorious. And remember, that ministry of Moses is the ministry that Paul, a Jew, was brought up on himself. Now, there seems to be some distortion of law teaching here. Elsewhere, Paul writes about how the law was given to lead us to Christ, but now the Christ has come. The clock hand has irreversibly moved from BC to AD. And these teachers have missed the Christ. They've left him and his grace out. You know how people love to caricature the Bible and divide it between an Old Testament that's all law and a New Testament that's all grace? I mean, it's a nonsense, of course. Once you start reading, you discover the Old Testament law is shot through with grace. The sacrificial system with the means of forgiveness. But this passage, it echoes our parody of the Old Testament, because when the one who is full of grace comes, when the full, final, complete sacrifice has been made, and he and his death on the cross have been ignored, well, the signposts have started to lose their meaning. And who wants the shadows when you can have the reality? So come and look at what he says about these religions, these ministries. Firstly, what I call the ministry of the Spirit, there in verses 7 to 11. The apostle's spoken of his ministry actually in the verse before where we picked it up, in verse 6, where he talks about how he and his friends are ministers of a new covenant, ministers of the Spirit, and he repeats the idea in verse 8, the ministry of the Spirit. The two, the new covenant and the Spirit, are linked together. Because God was well aware of the weakness of the old promise, the old covenant, or more accurately, not the weakness of the promise, but the weakness of us in keeping it. So through the prophet Ezekiel, for example, he speaks of a new day when he will bring a new promise, a new covenant, a day when I'll give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Well, the day's come. So here he contrasts two religions, two ministries. One has Moses and his law at its center. The other has Christ and his Spirit. And the first contrast is a stark one between death and life. Well, that's how he says it, isn't it, in verse 7. Now, if the ministry that brought death, which was engraved in letters on stone, came with glory, because, of course, it was a glory moment when Moses came down the mountain with those tablets of stone. And in the Ten Commandments and the expanded law, the people had the privilege of a knowledge of the living God, the Lord of heaven and earth, who he was, what he was like, what it means to live with him. The trouble is that to know it is one thing, to live it is quite another. At the end of the prosecution case, the defendant asked if he could change his plea from not guilty to guilty. "Why have you wasted so much of this court's time?" asked the judge quite reasonably. "I didn't realize," came the reply, "that the evidence against me was so strong." Well, the ministry of the law, the spelling out of God's commands, has that effect, doesn't it? It simply fingers you and me and sentences us. The ministry that brought death came with glory. But look, verse 8, if that's true, will not the ministry of the Spirit and the life he brings, a life I didn't possess and I can't earn, will not the ministry of the Spirit be even more glorious? To think that I could sit under a ministry that could bring the Spirit of the living God into my heart and soul, why sit under any other ministry? His next contrast just puts the same thing a different way. He contrasts condemnation with righteousness. Look at verse 9. If the ministry that brought condemnation was glorious. Glorious because the Ten Commandments do reveal the character of God. The trouble is they expose my character, and if I can be honest, yours as well, as very different. I've got a friend who loves his golf. Plays it regularly, enjoys it hugely. He just isn't very good at it. And he tells the story against himself of sort of realizing his dream and playing with a professional once for a round. And the first tee really summarized what happened. The professional teed off straight down the fairway. My friend hooked into the bushes. And for pretty much the whole round, that was it. He was a bit like a sort of yacht tacking in a strong wind. You know, went hook to slice, the professional straight down the fairway. They got to about the 12th hole. The professional straight down the fairway, my friend slices into the bushes, and as they go to look for the ball, the professional says, "Do you want a hand trying to find it?" And my friend just turned on him and said, "No, I just wish you'd go away." Well, the law does that to us, doesn't it? It just exposes us. If the ministry that brought condemnation was glorious, how much more glorious, he goes on in verse 9, is the ministry that brings righteousness, that brings the good news of the God who knows where I stand with his law, knows my failings, my shortcomings, my wrongdoings, but who, well, as the apostle will put it in a couple of chapters' time, in Christ was not counting people's sins against them. Look, forget any airs and graces for a moment. Forget trying to look respectable. I mean, if you're an instinctive blagger, forget trying to talk the good talk. More than anything else, I need a God who will not count my sins against me. More than anything else. And so do you. Or here's another contrast. It's there in verse 11. The contrast between what's temporary and what's permanent. If what was transitory, what was temporary, what was fading came with glory, how much greater is the glory of that which lasts? And we all want something that lasts, don't we? I mean, who wants a religion that's a fair weather friend, only of use until the hard times come? Who wants a ministry that can only serve me well for this life? I want to sit under a ministry, under a gospel that can nourish my heart and soul, not just for the here and now, but for all eternity. The Gospel of Moses had a built-in obsolescence. It was intended to lead me to the Gospel of Christ, the ministry that lasts. But put it all together and see the apostle's conclusion. It's there in verse 10. What was glorious, he says, And he's been very careful, hasn't he, not to badmouth the Old Testament. He'd be horrified to hear of Christians who only read the New Testament as if the Old wasn't our book as well. Every mention of the law has carried a reminder of its privilege and glory. But if the law never gets you beyond the book of Malachi, if it never carries you to the Messiah of the New Testament, well, verse 10, what was glorious has no glory now in comparison with the surpassing glory. See, have a power cut in the middle of the night, complete blackout, light a candle. It's very bright, isn't it, in a room? I mean, refreshingly, encouragingly bright. When the sun comes out in all its blazing power, you've got to look two or three times to see if the candles are light or not. I mean, the candle is completely outgunned, outdazzled by the vast wattage of the sun. It should be a no-brainer. But make sure you've got the right religion, you're enjoying the right ministry, the ministry of the Spirit. And next time you hear someone say anything like, why doesn't the church stick to the Ten Commandments? Don't forget to say, because we found something far better. The ministry of the Spirit. Second thing he mentions in this little section is what I've called the fruit of the Spirit. And I don't mean here the famous New Testament fruit of the Spirit from Galatians 5. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Essential and wonderful though they are. I mean other consequences that follow from the ministry of the Spirit. Things to expect as the gospel grips any life. Things to expect in years to come as the gospel grips Helen Joy's life. And the first of them is there in verses 12 and 13, what the apostle refers to as boldness. Therefore, verse 12, since we have such a hope, we are very bold. It's got the sense of outspoken. Not so much brash and pushy, more we use great freedom of speech. The Greeks, as you know, pioneered democracy about the 5th century BC, and they took pride in the idea that any and every citizen could say what they liked without fear of ostracism, the cold shoulder, or persecution. And very bold carries here the idea of speaking with nothing to hide. Very stunningly, he goes on, you see, we're very bold. Verse 13, we are not like Moses. He literally had to cover up. And Paul picks up on an incident, you can read about it in Exodus 34, where Moses' his face has a radiant glow when he emerges from speaking with the Lord, and the people are afraid, and he puts a veil over his face. And Paul highlights the fading glory. We're not like Moses, who would put a veil over his face to prevent the Israelites from seeing the end of what was passing away. We are very bold. We can speak and act like those with nothing to hide. I met Leslie last week. Leslie has serious learning difficulties. But a few years back, she found a group designed to help people like her, which also taught her the gospel of Jesus. It was a story, a truth she'd never heard before. But Leslie, after a while, turned to Christ. What difference did he make? She chuckled at that question. I don't stop talking now, she answered. Before I was very quiet. I would just have sat here, hands folded in my lap, taking it all in. Reality check came instantly. She said, well, taking in as much as I could. Now I don't stop talking. I'm enjoying being who God made me to be. She doesn't just talk about Jesus, but he's certainly part of her conversation. She speaks as someone who's got nothing to hide. Now, I'm not saying that every Christian's got to be a chatterbox, but it's not as if there's Leslie, and then one day you may, if you're lucky, discover there's another secret side to her life with Jesus in it. Now, she's all part of a whole, speaks quite freely. I wonder how people would find us. You know, the people we mix with, work with, talk with, school gate, office water cooler, coffee shop. Would they find us veiled? Or like those with nothing to hide? Is the fruit of the Spirit ripening in your life? very bold, nothing to hide. Here's another part of that fruit, freedom. Look at verse 17, the end of this little section. It summarizes much of what's being said here. Now, the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Don't let that word pass by you too lightly. It ought to shape our understanding and our living. See, to become a Christian is not to let yourself in for a life of rules and regulations. It's to head for a life of freedom. I've no doubt Helen Joy will discover rules. She's probably been told them already. She'll be taught the commandments. But if she learns Christ, she'll learn freedom. Freedom to know God. That veil Moses put over his face, Paul picks up and uses as a symbol of the veil over human minds and hearts in verses 14 and 15. It leaves us with dull minds and unbelieving hearts. It explains the spiritual insensitivity that can't understand. You see, look at verse 14. To this day, the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. Verse 15. Even to this day, when Moses is read, a veil covers their heart. When the law is read in the synagogues, they still can't understand that God is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. I came across the story of Yoel this week. Yoel was born to a Jewish mother, Scottish dad, brought up with a number of Jewish customs, but not a real grip of a Jewish religion. And he says, in my teenage years, I wanted to find out more about God, so I started reading. I went to the vicar at the school in England. I asked him to give some books about God, including the Quran, some Hindu writings. And I was reading the Quran on my bed. I remember putting the book down, and the thought came to me that if God exists, I shouldn't really have to read these books. Rather, he should just show up. So I said, God, if you're real, show up. And before me, I saw the face of Jesus. I looked at it. I felt the presence in my room. I felt afraid. I saw a clear vision of God and ignored it. I decided it was a figment of my imagination. I put it down to the fact that I was living in a Christian culture, and so something had affected my thinking. I decided to put the whole experience out of my mind. Some years later, he comes to Israel. He meets Adele, who will later be his wife, and we started discussing and philosophizing about God. We now realize we knew nothing, but at the time, we were very intense and really searching to find the truth. And eventually we decided that if we believed in God, we were being hypocritical if we didn't do something about it. I suppose it started out as a sort of experiment. We began observing Shabbat, the Sabbath. I would study the Torah, the law, and other writings through the night. We became more orthodox. We left language school. We were living together. So gradually the idea of doing that and not being married seemed wrong. We were faced with a choice: separate or get married. We knew we were right for each other, so why wait? Well, they get married. Some years later, Yoel's doing military service. He's starting to read through his Bible, the Old Testament. He gets beyond the Pentateuch. He gets into the prophets. He eventually comes to that great chapter in Isaiah 53, about the suffering servant who would suffer for his people. He's talking about it with a Christian friend they've met who speaks of Jesus. And as he listens, half of him realizes the truth about it. The other half is resisting. He said, obviously, all the reasons why I shouldn't believe started coming into my mind. Number one, I was a soldier in the rabbinical corps. It's a pretty powerful reason. Number two, my mum would freak out. Probably an even more powerful reason, isn't it? All my life, she told me, I'll always love you unless you become gay or believe in Jesus. So thoughts of rejection from my family came into my mind. Judy, the friend, was still speaking. She kept on talking, and it sounded like Chinese. Today, I know as an evangelist that something prevents us from seeing and believing these basic truths. Call it the veil, if you like. But it's not an incurable disease. It needn't be a terminal illness. Look at verse 16. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. He's the key. The one to whom the law points full of grace and truth. And the great Christian testimony doesn't start with a dramatic lifestyle change. It's always got this at its heart. Once I was blind, but now I see. Talking to an 18-year-old, not 10 days old as a Christian, unsure whether it was for real, lacking in anything dramatic to point to. And as we were talking, he let slip, I picked up a Bible last Sunday. I've started reading it. It's beginning to make sense. The Spirit at work. Once I was blind, now I can see. One of my great heroes is William Grimshaw, a Yorkshire vicar in the days of the Wesleys and Whitfield. And it was said of him after his conversion, if God had drawn up his Bible to heaven and sent down another, it wouldn't have been newer to him. Once I was blind, now I can see. See, it means God is no longer a mystery. It's not we can dot every I and cross every T and tie up every loose end about God. Oh, there are some people temperamentally who love to do that, but it just shrivels God. It is that mystery is not the primary category in which to think of God. He's the God who rescues from sin and death. That's why there's nothing to hide from him. He knows it all and he's dealt with it all. As a Christian, I can enjoy the freedom to know him and to come humbly but boldly into his presence. The Lord, verse 17, is the Spirit. And these Corinthian Christians, they prided themselves on the Spirit's gifting of them. You have the Spirit, the apostle says. You know this Lord. Don't turn back. Don't try and turn the clock back to BC. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. If you read to the very end of the book of Exodus, after chapter upon chapter of descriptions of how the tent temple, the tabernacle, is to be built, it ends with this: then the cloud covered the tent of meeting and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of the meeting because the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter. In Christ, we're free to. By His Spirit, the glory is brought to us. Boldness, freedom. Are you enjoying it? Last part, change. Change. Now, there's a word that we don't automatically associate with Christians. Shame on us. We're intended to be changed people. I mean, look at verse 18. We who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, we do, even if our reflection is only a pale shadow. But you'll see there's a footnote by that word, and the footnote is also true that the sentence can carry both meanings, both seem appropriate here. We reflect the Lord's glory or we contemplate the Lord's glory. I mean, that's the lifelong mark of any Christian focused on Jesus, who he is, what he did in that great hour of glory around the cross. And it comes from sitting under a new covenant ministry, a ministry of the Spirit. It comes from our personal Bible reading. And as our eyes focus that way, look what God is doing. We who reflect, who contemplate the Lord's glory, are being transformed, being changed into his likeness. That's the change, the transformation Christians are constantly experiencing. And not always the change we want from God's Spirit. Now, too often we look for so many other things, you know, normally onward and upward, isn't it? The job, either any job or the promotion job. The relationship that I've always longed for. The health I fear is slipping away. The education, at least for the kids. But the fruit of the Spirit is to be transformed into His, Christ's likeness. And I've seen Christ's likeness in unemployed people. In those who've never been able to change their status on Facebook. in the wheelchair bound and even the bedridden, in those who've had to teach themselves to read in order to read the Bible, being transformed into his likeness. There's the fruit, with ever increasing glory. Did you spot that? It's not a one-step miracle. The old versions used to speak of from one degree of glory to another. I think they caught the sense well of continuous change. Now look, I mean, lodge it in your brain. Isn't it a remarkable thought? Isn't it an encouraging thought that you can see something of the glory of God in a Christian? You know, walk through the doors of work tomorrow and you take with you the Spirit of God. Something of reflection of God comes with you as you step over the threshold. Remember that on Monday morning. And look again at verse 18. We are being transformed into his likeness with ever increasing glory. Embrace the change. Too many of us settle for where we are. Well, God isn't resigned to us stopping growing. God hasn't settled for I'll never be where the end of the sentence is Christ-likeness. Embrace the change. 2012, it's a year with all kinds of worrying fears and exciting distractions built in, but for every Christian in this room, it's a year when God has marked you down for change. By 2013, he wants you to look, he wants you to be more Christ-like than we are now. Embrace the change. John Newton, the great slave trader, converted, became a minister and a hymn writer. He embraced the change. He knew this fruit of the Spirit. Here's what he said. I'm not what I ought to be. I'm not what I want to be. But I'm not what I was. And I'm not what I'm going to be. And by the grace of God, I am what I am. The fruit of the Spirit. Boldness. Freedom, change. Have you tasted them? Are you enjoying them? As a Christian, they're your promise. And our last hymn picks up the very thoughts. Look at this last verse as it speaks of love divine. It speaks of us changed from glory into glory till in heaven we take our place. Let's stand and sing of the love that can do that for us.